Accession number 30078, real 8.
Emerson, real 8. Yes, you're describing Poussin.
But before we actually got to Poussin, fate struck again, keeps striking all the time in my life. About 3 days before, I had the most tremendous pain in my side of my stomach. And it took me, I think, something like 3/4 of an hour to get the 100 yards from my cabin down to the sick bay. And when I got there, the doctor pushed and heaved and said, "You've got a gallbladder. It's really badly swollen up." So I was kept in the sick bay, and I remember I was carried off on a stretcher, the first off the boat, and looking up the decks above, all lined with the soldiers, all yelling out, "Ah, you bloody lazy bugger, oh, you coward, you're getting off that way." Anyhow, I was taken to a MASH, an American Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, where they weren't going to operate. That was going to be done on the British, but they looked after me for about 4 days, mainly with painkillers and trying to dampen down the pain. It was really hurting badly. One or two quite amusing things happened in that at the end of the bed there was a little name plaque, and it had Emerson, Australian Army. And a Negro came along and looked at it and said, "Man, do you speak English?" So I said, "Well, I think the Australians all do, but with a different accent to yours." But I was well treated by them, and then put on to, I think it was a Dakota plane, and flown across to Koure, which was the British headquarters, and had been, you remember, in the occupation. It had been reopened up while the Korean War was on, and I was operated on the hospital there. After a number of days in hospital, I was sent down to Miyajima, which was a lovely island in the inland sea, which was the recuperation place. They'd taken over a Japanese hotel right on the beach. There were only about three of us in there, and it was a really good holiday. But as it had been very bad, apparently, the gallbladder, and so there'd been a big operation to cut wide open and got it out. So I had quite some time there. And then I was, of course, classified as not fit for service for a bit. And I didn't want to hang around. I didn't think they wanted me around. And I heard on the grapevine that one or two of the staff captains in the division in Korea, Commwaldiv, Britcom, they were due for replacement. So I sent the word up that I'd be happy to go over on the staff. As the phony war was on, there was no question of being terribly physically fit, and didn't look as though it was going to restart. So I was then sent over.
This was in the spring of 1953, was it?
This would be the autumn, about autumn of 1953, I think, as far as I can remember.
After the Panmunjom talks? After the peace talks?
Yes, oh yes, yes. There was, as I said earlier on, there was the phony peace was on then. I was then sent up as Staff Captain Q to the headquarters of the BRITCOM, British Commonwealth Forces, BCOF, I think it was, BCFK, British Commonwealth Forces Korea. And so I settled into the headquarters there, where they had been erecting Nissen huts and then partitioning them. You've got a partition to yourself. In a little valley facing Castle Hill, which was the hill on which the Gloucesters had done their terrific stand and where they'd won that VC. We were facing onto that. We were up a side valley with the officers' mess at the top of it. Quite honestly, I knew nothing whatsoever about Q staff work. Inside me, I was somewhat worried as to whether I'd be able to sort it out. But it all fell into place slowly. And the fellow who was there, a real Australian, who was going back to Australia, I was with him for about a week. And he was very good. He explained the whole thing to me and the setup. The DAQMG was a Canadian. The colonel of the divisional headquarters was an Australian of a very sour disposition. And then, of course, there was the general above, whose name I can't remember, and with whom I had almost nothing to do. Right, well, life went on then as a staff officer, really. I got around quite a bit. I didn't have a vehicle of my own, but in the next cabin to me was a fellow called Norman Phillips, who was the air interpretation officer of the photographs and things like that. I forget what he was actually called, something like BAPU, British Army Photographic Interpretation Unit. And he had this BAPIU up on the windscreen of his Jeep, but he had a Jeep to himself. And being friends, we went all over the place, outer bounds, inbounds, to the American camps. A lot of swapping went on between us and the Americans. We had things they wanted, they had things we wanted. Every so long in that Jeep, Norman Phillips used to get stopped, and people would say, "What's this BAIPU?" And he'd say, "Sorry, BAPIU." And he would say, "It's the British Army Pornographic Issue Unit." And to do it, he always, in his pocket of his Jeep, he had three or four pictures of naked women and that. And he said, "Yeah, that's the type of stuff we hand out." The Americans' all reaction was really funny. They said, "Gee, that's the sort of unit we ought to have." Anyhow, time just passed that way. I had to go down to Seoul two or three times, which was really just a journey down to headquarters to take information and stuff like that down. And then towards the end of the first year, you were only meant to be up there a year and they would rotate you. I thought, well, I'm happy here, I'm settled in, it's comfortable, I'm pretty free, and I can get around if I want to. So I volunteered for another year. So I stayed up there 2 years. And also I got another responsibility, which was much more interesting, that once a month at the border between the two countries, Panmunjom, no, not Panmunjom, that's the name of the town, I forget the name of the area, there where the two lines met, there was a meeting once a month of the Allies and the North Koreans, and you swapped information about how many arms and stuff you'd brought in, they told you how many they brought in, and various details like that. That was my responsibility, although I didn't do the talking, that was always the colonel represented us. But I had to sit there with the papers and feed the information to him. But it was quite interesting to go up there because of the military police stationed on both sides, glaring at each other and glaring at you, putting on an assumed inimical attitude. But it made a break, and it was quite a good journey. It took a whole day to get there and back and do it. Meanwhile, staff work just went on, and then I think about three quarters of the way through my second year there, we'd been now coming 1956, it was decided that they were going to cut down on numbers a bit. And can you switch off for a second? Did you switch him? So they were running down a little bit, so it became time to be sent back to Australia. So first of all, they sent me back to Japan by rail, boat and rail on the other side, back to Kure, where I stayed for just over a month, filling in for a staff captain there who'd gone on long leave. Then onto a troop ship which was returning quite a lot of Australian soldiers back to Australia, and came back to Sydney around about, I think this was about the middle of 1956. By the way, I forgot to mention that I was on a 5-year contract. They gave us all contracts with the option of extending should I want to. This meant that I had, I think, about another 9 months to go. Well, I had accrued 6 months' leave. So I thought, well, I'll jolly well take it. And I had a rather nice car, which I then drove right across New South Wales, up to Alice Springs, right down to Adelaide, and then all along the southern shore coast to Melbourne and back up to Sydney. And that took most of my 6 months. I did it in my own time, stayed where I wanted. I think I spent 3 weeks at Alice Springs, and just wandering and looking. Got back, which left me a very short time to go, so they sent me back up to the 13th National Service Training Battalion, where I stayed, I think, for another 4 months, just doing odd jobs. Then they asked me what I was going to do about my contract. Well, in the meanwhile, I'd been getting some letters from my mother, well, first of all, from my sister, to say my mother wasn't at all well. Then from my mother, the usual thing, I'd like to see you before I go, and so on and so on and so on. And I really felt that I'd been away most of my life. I ought to do what she wanted. Well, I wouldn't get leave to come back to England. I'd have to just not take an extension. Whether it was a bribe to get me to stay, I don't know. But when I was asked about what I wanted to do, they said there was a vacancy as adjutant at Woomera, the atom bomb camp. Was I interested? I was, but I'd made up my mind to come home, and I told my mother I was going to, so I thought I'd better stick to it. So I finished my service and then wandered home. It actually took me over a year to get home, stopping off all over the place, and that was the end of my military service.
Before you left the Australian Army, how much awareness of the Korean War was there in Britain?
Oh, quite a lot. I mean, it's been publicised and in the newspapers all the time. And of course, there were British troops involved almost from the beginning. I always thank God that I wasn't in the British Army, who went out at the very beginning, because they had just ordinary battle dress and that type of thing. And the winter out in Korea is absolutely fearsome. It wasn't until after the first winter when the Allied troops began to receive combat jackets and things like that and proper winter clothing. I think I once worked it out that when full winter was on, I had something like 23 pieces of clothing on me, if you count every individual sock and glove and inner glove and pants and inner pants and scarf, everything. I think it was about 23 pieces of clothing, and even then you were cold, because you see, we were facing north, so the wind blowing most of the time was coming from Siberia, and it just went straight through you. It was bitterly cold. No, there was awareness in England, and I had thought, well, as I'd mentioned to you in the other interview, that while in India all those years, I never really went into action anywhere. I had thought, well, it might be a chance to do so, but I was more attracted by the travel and the chance to go somewhere. And of course, being in their army and enlisted therefore over here, I had all the journey paid for me.
How did the Australian Army differ in terms of its organisation?
Well, the organisation was exactly the same as the English Army, completely the same. But the big difference I noticed is when out on a scheme, very second time I was out as company commander, I got lost, in that I didn't know where the hell I was on the map. Now, in the Indian Army, the troops would just stand around me, wait for you to make your mind up. The British Army would probably say, well, I don't know, I think we're here, but I'm not sure. But the Australian Army, everybody had an idea. And every man said, no, mate, we're over here. No, we're not, we're over there. But I then learnt that in future, if ever I was foxed on anything, let them all have their say and pick the wisest one and say, well, now what I think is this. Went down quite well, actually. It was rather more informal between officers and men. It's difficult to give my feelings about a unit in Australia, because national service is a rather different setup to a normal battalion. And again, you see, in Korea, I was on the staff the whole time, so I've never actually served with an actual battalion. So I don't really know. One unusual thing, though, when I was doing the company commander of the National Service Unit, they were told that they were going to have a platoon of conscientious objectors who had to do their training. The Australians wouldn't let them off it, but they needn't touch any weapons. They needn't handle weapons. So it was given to me. God knows why. Maybe it was a punishment, but I got it. And actually, they turned out to be the best recruits we've ever had in every other way. The spit and polish, drill, everything was absolutely perfect. And what was amusing, that over the 9 months or so of their training, I think about at least five of them quietly asked the sergeant to ask me if they could go on the rifle range with an ordinary company to see how it worked. And they went and fired a rifle, but officially they weren't meant to touch any weapons at all. But I must say they were one of the best platoons I've ever had otherwise.
Did any of them give up their conscientious objections?
No, not to my knowledge. I mean, I took them through the training and they were discharged. What happened afterwards, I don't know. I think many of them were religious bases, and so I think they stuck to it probably.
Did the equipment in the Australian Army differ much from what you've been used to?
Well, it differed in that it was a more advanced, better equipment. In India, we'd started off with the old fabric webbing, you know, the webbing equipment, and then it had changed during the war. With the Australian Army, it was much more like American equipment. But that had happened everywhere. It was just that I'd been away in between for years, so there'd been all these changes. But otherwise, they were equipped very much as a British soldier. I think you'll find you could put your Australian and your British soldier together, and there'd be very little difference in their equipment and how they dealt with things and what happened to them, except the Australian was a little bit more open-minded and freer with his drink.
What was their enthusiasm for the war or otherwise like in Korea?
In Australia, there wasn't much enthusiasm. This is why they asked for officers who had been serving elsewhere, because so many Australians who'd been during the World War, and they'd had a hell of a time down in the Pacific, they said, no, I'm not bloody well going back into the services again, so they wouldn't join up again. And so they couldn't get enough officers, and that's why they took us from outside. I don't think they took a large number of us, but they had to take some to keep things ticking over. It was looked upon as a bloody nuisance, the war. Really no more than that, but they were prepared to do their part. I don't know what the feeling really amongst soldiers was, because, as I say, when I was up there, there was a phony peace on, and so you just looked upon it as another duty, as far as I can take it.
What sort of state was Korea itself in during the time you were
there? It was in a shocking mess, because, you see, the North Koreans had come down against the South Koreans, and they'd got almost down to the south when the Americans went in at Busan and formed a border. So stuff had been damaged in the fighting there. Then the Americans pushed the North Koreans right back, so more damage was done. Just the other side of the 38th parallel, the Chinese had come in on the side of the North Koreans. Things were reversed and everything came down south again. And then slowly the Americans pushed the Chinese back until they got roughly to the 38th parallel, and that meant the area had been gone over four times. So Seoul, for instance, was quite battered around. You could find derelict buildings around the place, but people were rebuilding then. Of course, I've seen pictures now. It's just like Tokyo or New York or anything like that. But you could see the signs of war all around. And one of the saddest things was that, of course, with all the movement of people and the killing of a lot of civilians, there are a mass of children with no parents, orphan children. And we found that many of the little country shrines, which often were apart from the village, they were up on a hill on their own, had formed themselves in little orphanages. The priest had taken in 15, 20 children and somehow managed to look after them. And I know of two other officers and myself. We each adopted one orphanage, and there was a surfeit of rations and stuff up in Korea. So we quietly cornered, especially as I was on the Q branch, we quietly cornered what rations I could every so long. And then we would get a lorry from the New Zealand GPT company, and one afternoon we'd drive over and dump the food on them, and they would put on a little dance for us and some entertainment, some tea and that. It helped, because otherwise these kids had nothing. I was given a nice little scroll in English and Korean thanking me for doing all this. It looked very important, but it isn't really. But that happened, as I say, I know of three other officers who did it, and I think the Americans did it in quite a bigger way, because the Americans are very, very generous, and they must have seen it. But all over the place there were orphans. You could see the devastation of war.
Within the Commonwealth Division itself, how did the different nationalities relate to each other?
Well, we had Australian, New Zealand, British and Canadian. The Canadian each had their own brigade. The Canadian was known as the Cadillac Brigade because they had American equipment, American rations, and had damn sight better pay than we did. So they were always known as the Cadillac Brigade. The Australians, the same as the British, really, same rations, same everything else. There wasn't a lot of interchange, I think, between the three brigades. But, of course, when you got to things like divisional headquarters, you had people from all four countries mixed doing various jobs. As I say, my QM, DAQMG was a Canadian. I was English, or Australian Army, if you like. There was an English Army fellow working alongside me as Staff Captain A. There was a New Zealander, a lieutenant, I forget what he did. So we were all thoroughly mixed. So we just got along as a normal group. I don't recall any interracial, if I can use it that way, interracial fighting. There were certain attributes about people. I mean, the Australians were I couldn't care less, damn the discipline attitude. The British were normal British Army attitude to everything. The New Zealanders, they had a GPT company there, General Purpose Transport Company. They were nearly all Maoris, and they were a wonderful bunch. They would get caught maybe speeding by the MPs, and whereas other people would argue, the Maori would just look out and say, oh, well, that's fate. And when I used to get the Maori driver to take up my orphanage and that, he mucked in as though he was all part of the thing. And they used to have a hangi. A hangi is where they cook pigs on hot stones underneath that. They used to throw a great big hangi about three times a year. And you could be sure that some one or two villages nearby would come to headquarters and complain that their pigs have been stolen. And so you get on to the Maoris, and a Maori officer would turn up with a big smile on his face and produce a receipt or two receipts for pigs. They were the same receipts every time. Kept just producing, ah, we bought them, here are the receipts. They were super parties, those. And they asked all nationalities over, a limited number, obviously, but quite a crowd, put on Maori dance and so on. On the whole, I think everybody got on very well. The Canadians, as I say, were known as the Cadillac Division, and the Canadian Brigade store was something to visit. It was absolutely loaded with everything, much of it American. And when the Canadians were due to leave, the duty officer one night received a call from the Canadian division saying, I'm sorry, we've got a report that our store's on a fire. We're trying to put it out, but it's a big blaze. The whole store burnt down, and we think it was to cover up some very... I won't say unnecessary things, but extra kit and other stuff that may have been there, but it was just a coincidence that time came to move the store burnt down.
How were relations with the Americans?
Quite good, because A, of course, we were separated from them. On our right, we had, I think it was the 23rd American Division. I'm not sure of that, but we had the... I know their tank company, the 7th Tank Company, and they're all from Texas. But there was a hill range between us and them. On the left, we had the American Marines. We would go down and visit them sometimes in their mess. They were perfectly hospitable, and we got on quite well. Don't remember many Americans coming to us, probably because we didn't have much to offer. Down from where I was in my little tent, I could see the plain below right up to the Imjin River, and there was a small aerodrome in that for the artillery spotter planes, which were known as TWA, Teeny Weeny Airways, and quite often you would see somebody stagger out with a pair of PT shoes and a pair of shorts on, get into one of those, take off over the hill to the Americans. After about 2 or 3 hours, back over the hill he came with American cigarettes and everything else. He'd been to their PX and looked upon as quite normal, probably written up in the book as a reconnaissance or something. But as I say, we didn't have a lot of contact with them, but on the whole it was fairly good.
And what about the South Koreans?
Well, of course, they were all around us. Now, we had the Korean army was mobilized, obviously. And to every regiment, British, Australian, Canadian, there were, I think, about 10 Korean soldiers attached. And the idea was that they would act both as interpreters to the local people, and they knew the lay of the land and all this sort of thing. They were generally to help you get on and in with the Koreans. With us, they were known as CATCOMs, that's Korean Army Troops Commonwealth. And with the Americans, they were KATUSA, Korean Army Troops USA. And they wore our uniform, or the American uniform, and they looked exactly like our people. The only difference would come in the winter when it was so cold. A lot of troops of ours didn't really wash very much, and you could see high water marks around the collar, whereas the CATCOMs were always superbly turned out, beautifully clean. We had a Korean major, a Captain Song, and I think about 8 or 9 CATCOMs, and they were spread out due to each brigade, two at headquarters. And as I say, their job was to liaise between you and the local population and that sort of thing. Apart from that, there wasn't much contact with the population, except that there were obviously the girls. I mean, naturally, all the troops were looking for girls, so every village would probably have some girls outside wandering around waiting. I forget, there was a nickname for them. I forget it, what it was. I had to go into Seoul twice to take details on that in, and I went in by helicopter because we had helicopters up there with us, and he came and landed at our headquarters, and he said, "Oh, you want to see something on this journey, an American?" And he swooped down over each village, pointed out the girls all standing around, and he had small bags of flour. He bombarded them from above once or twice. But that's really about the only contact. Of course, it was forbidden. There were military police out, there were patrols out all over the place. And actually, you were forbidden even to buy from the small Korean shops. I inadvertently once did stop at a shop. I forget what it was I'd seen. I wanted to buy, and I was in the process of buying it when a military policeman came up and said, "You know, you're not allowed to do that. I have to report you." Fortunately, I chatted up that I'd been a military policeman before in Japan and this, that, and the other. And he said, "Oh, well, go away and don't do it again." But I hadn't realized, quite truthfully, that buying in a shop was forbidden as well.